Five focusing steps. 1. Identify the system's constraint. 2. Decide how to exploit the system's constraint. 3. Subordinate everything else to the above decisions. 4. Elevate the system's constraint. 5. If in the previous steps a constraint has been broken, go back to step 1, but do not allow inertia to cause a system constraint. Standing on the shoulders of giants. Production concepts versus production applications. The Hitachi tool engineering example. One of Ellie Goldratt's convictions was that the goal of an individual or an organization should not be defined in absolute terms. A good definition of a goal is one that sets us on a path of ongoing improvement. Pursuing such a goal necessitates more than one breakthrough. In fact, it requires many. To be in a position to identify these breakthroughs, we should have a deep understanding of the underlying rules of our environment. 25 years after writing The Goal, Dr. Goldratt wrote Standing on the Shoulders of Giants. In this article, he provided the underlying rules of operations. This article is included here in his memory. Introduction. It's easy to trace the popularity of lean production to Toyota's success. Toyota's success was undeniable. Toyota manufactured as many cars as the traditional leader, GM, and did it while making profits. Between 2003 and 2008, Toyota's average net profit over sales was 70% higher than the industry average, while GM was losing money. The success of Toyota is fully attributed to the Toyota Production System, TPS. At least, this is the conviction of Toyota's management. The stated number one challenge of Toyota is to pass TPS on as the company's DNA to the next generation. Given that Toyota is the flagship of Japan's industry, one should expect that lean would be widely implemented in Japan. Surprisingly, this is not the case. It is commonly known in Japan that less than 20% of the manufacturers have implemented lean. How come? It is not because they did not try to implement it. Many companies in Japan put serious efforts into trying to implement lean, but failed. One such company is Hitachi Tool Engineering. Their inability to implement lean cannot be explained by a lack of serious efforts. This company repeatedly tried to implement lean, but the deterioration in production performance forced them to go back to the more traditional ways of managing production. Likewise, the fact that most of Japanese industry did not implement lean cannot be attributed to a lack of sufficient knowledge. Toyota was more than generous in sharing their knowledge. This company put all the TPS knowledge in the public domain and even went as far as inviting their direct competitors to visit their plants. Hitachi, like so many other companies, was using the available knowledge and was not shy about hiring the help of the best experts available. There is an explanation to these companies' failure to implement lean. An explanation that is apparent to any objective observer of a company like Hitachi Tool Engineering. The failure is due to the fundamental difference in the production environments. When Taiichi Ono developed TPS, he didn't do it in the abstract. He developed it for his company. It's no wonder that the powerful application that Ono developed might not work in fundamentally different production environments. But that doesn't mean that Ono's work cannot be extremely valuable for other environments. The genius of Ono is fully revealed when we realized that he faced the exact same situation. At that time, the production system that revolutionized production was the flow line method that Henry Ford developed. Ford's method was already used not only for almost all vehicle assembly, but also in very different industries like beverages and ammunition. Also at that time, it was already accepted that flow lines can and must be implemented only in environments where the required quantities justify dedication of equipment to a single product Whenever production quantities were not big enough, no one contemplated the possibility of using lines. No one except for Ono. Ono realized that the concepts that underlie Ford's system are generic, that his application is restricted to certain types of environments, but the concepts are universal. Ono had the clear vision to start from the concepts, the genius to design an application that's suitable for Toyota's environment, where it is not feasible to dedicate equipment to the production of a component, and the tenacity to overcome the huge obstacles standing in the way of implementing such an application. The result is TPS. Rather than refraining from using the right concepts, or even worse, trying to force the application in environments that are apparently too different, we should follow in Ono's footsteps. In this paper, we'll present the fundamental concepts of flow, the concepts that Lean is based upon, a generic application of these concepts that can be used in a much wider spectrum of environments, and the impressive results Hitachi Tool Engineering achieved with this broader application. Historical perspective. The manufacturing industry has been shaped by two great thinkers, Henry Ford and Taiichi Ono. Ford revolutionized mass production by introducing the flow lines. Ono took Ford's ideas to the next level in his TPS, a system that forced the entire industry to change its grasp of inventory from an asset to a liability. Ford's starting point was that the key for effective production is to concentrate on improving the overall flow of products through the operations. His efforts to improve flow were so successful that by 1926, the lead time from mining the iron ore to having a completed car composed of more than 5,000 parts on the train ready for delivery was 81 hours. 80 years later, no car manufacturer in the world has been able to achieve or even come close to such a short lead time. Flow means that inventories in the operation are moving. When inventory is not moving, inventory accumulates. Accumulation of inventory takes up space. Therefore, an intuitive way to achieve better flow is to limit the space allowed for inventory to accumulate. To achieve better flow, Ford limited the space allotted for work in process between each two work centers. That is the essence of the flow lines, as can be verified by the fact that the first flow lines didn't have any mechanical means like conveyors to move inventory from one work center to another. The daring nature of Ford's method is revealed when one realizes that a direct consequence of limiting the space is that when the allotted space is full, the workers feeding it must stop producing. Therefore, in order to achieve flow, Ford had to abolish local efficiencies. In other words, flow lines are flying in the face of conventional wisdom. The convention that, to be effective, every worker and every work center have to be busy 100% of the time. One might think that preventing resources from working continuously will decrease throughput, output of the operation. That undesirable effect might have been the result if Ford would have been satisfied with just limiting the space. But there is another effect that stems from restricting the accumulation of inventory. It makes it very visible to spot the real problems that jeopardize the flow. When one work center in a line stops producing for more than a short while, soon the whole line stops. Ford took advantage of the resulting clear visibility to better balance the flow by addressing and eliminating the apparent stoppages. The end result of abolishing local efficiencies and balancing the flow is a substantial increase in throughput. Henry Ford achieved the highest throughput per worker of any car manufacturing company of his time. In summary, Ford's flow lines are based on the following four concepts. 1. Improving flow, or equivalently lead time, is a primary objective of operations. 2. This primary objective should be translated into a practical mechanism that guides the operation when not to produce, prevents overproduction. 3. local efficiencies must be abolished. 4. A focusing process to balance flow must be in place. Like Ford, Ono's primary objective was improving flow, decreasing lead time, as indicated in his response to the question about what Toyota is doing. All we are doing is looking at the timeline from the moment the customer gives us an order to the point when we collect the cash, and we are reducing that timeline. Ono faced an almost insurmountable obstacle when he came to apply the second concept. When the demand for a single product is high, dedicating a line to producing each component, as Ford did, is justified. However, at that time in Japan, the market demand was for small quantities of a variety of cars. Therefore, Ono could not dedicate lines at Toyota. As we already said, all other industries that faced this situation simply did not contemplate using lines. Ono, however, was toying with the idea of using lines when the equipment is not dedicated, when each work center is producing a variety of components. The problem was that, in this case, using the mechanism of limited space would lead to gridlocks. Not all components are available for assembly. Assembly cannot work while the allotted space is already full. Feeding lines are prevented from working. Ono writes that he realized the solution when he heard about supermarkets, much before he actually saw a supermarket during his visit to the U.S. in 1956. He realized that both supermarkets and the feeding lines at Toyota needed to manage a large variety of products. In the supermarkets, products were not jam-packing the aisles. Rather, most merchandise was held in the backroom storage. In the store itself, each product was allocated a limited shelf space. Only after a product was taken by a shopper was replenishment from the backroom storage triggered to refill that product's allotted shelf space. What Ono envisioned is the mechanism that would enable him to guide Toyota's operation when not to produce. Rather than using a single limited space between work centers to restrict work-in-process production, he had to limit the amount allowed to accumulate of each component specifically. Based on that realization, Ono designed the Kanban system. The Kanban system has been described in numerous articles and books. In this article, I'll describe just the essence to show how true Ono was to the fundamental concepts. Between each two work centers and for each component separately, the accumulation of inventory is limited by setting a certain number of containers and the number of units per container. These containers, like every container in every industry, also contain the relevant paperwork. But one page of the paperwork, usually a card, Kanban in Japanese, a page that specifies only the component code name and the number of units per container, is treated in an unconventional way. When the succeeding work center withdraws a container for further processing, that card is not moved with the container. Rather, it is passed back to the preceding work center. This is the notification to that work center that a container was withdrawn, that the allotted inventory is not full. Only in that case is the preceding work center allowed to produce one container of parts specified by the card. In essence, the Kanban system directs each work center when and what to produce, but more importantly, it directs when not to produce. No card, no production. The Kanban system is the practical mechanism that guides the operation when not to produce, prevents overproduction. Ono succeeded to expand Ford's concepts by changing the base of the mechanism from space to inventory. Adhering to the flow concept mandates the abolishment of local efficiencies. Ono addressed this issue again and again in his books, stressing that there's no point in encouraging people to produce if the products are not needed in the very short term. This emphasis is probably the reason that outside Toyota, TPS first became known as just-in-time production. Once the Kanban system, the system that guides the operation when not to produce, was implemented on the shop floor, the immediate reduction in throughput mandated a mammoth effort to balance the flow. The challenge that Ono faced was orders of magnitude bigger than the one Ford faced. To realize how big the challenge was, it's enough to highlight just one aspect out of the many. Unlike in dedicated line environments, Ono's system forced a work center to frequently switch from producing one component to another. For most work centers, every such switch necessitates spending time to do the required setup. Since the containers, by design, called for a relatively small number of parts, the production batches that they dictated were, many times, ridiculously smaller relative to the setup required. Initially, for many work centers, the time required for setups was more than the time required for production, resulting in a significant drop in throughput. It's no wonder that Ono faced enormous resistance, so much so that Ono wrote that his system was referred to as the abominable Ono system from the late 1940s to the early 1960s. Ono and his superiors certainly had an extraordinary determination and vision to continue to push for the implementation of a system that, for any person who looked at it from a local perspective, as most shop personnel must have, simply didn't make sense. Ono had to pave a new way to overcome the setup obstacle. At the time, and until TPS became famous worldwide, the traditional way to deal with setups was to increase the batch size. Economical batch quantity was the popular name on which thousands of articles were written. Ono ignored all that body of knowledge, since yielding to using economical quantities would have doomed his quest to reduce the lead times. Rather, he insisted that the setups required are not cast in stone, that the processes can be modified to drastically reduce the setup time required. He led the efforts to develop and implement setup reduction techniques that eventually reduced all setup times in Toyota to be at most just a few minutes. It's no wonder that Lean is now strongly associated with small batches and setup reduction techniques. But the need to balance the flow necessitated much more than just dealing with the setup obstacle. The fact that most work centers were not dedicated to a single component made it almost impossible to spot by direct observation the real problems which jeopardized the flow. Ono was fully aware that there were too many things that could be improved, that without a way to focus the process improvement efforts, it would take too long to balance the flow. The Kanban system provided him such a way. The rocks and water analogy of Lean is useful for understanding how this is done. The water level corresponds to the inventory level, while the rocks are the problems disturbing the flow. There are many rocks at the bottom of the river, and it takes time and effort to remove them. The question is which rocks are important to remove. The answer is given by reducing the water level. Those rocks which emerge above the water are the ones that should be removed. At the initiation of the Kanban system, to achieve reasonable throughput, Ono had to start with many containers, each holding a non-negligible quantity of a particular part. Gradually, Ono reduced the number of containers and then the quantities in each container. If the flow was not noticeably disturbed, then the reduction of the number of containers and quantities per container continued. When the flow was disturbed, the five whys method was used to pinpoint the root cause. It had to be fixed before the quantities could be further reduced. It took time, but the end result was a remarkable improvement in productivity. It should be noted that even though, in the last 20 years, every other car company has implemented one version or another of the Toyota system and reaped major benefits, the productivity of Toyota is unmatched by any other car company. This fact points to the importance of making the correct choice of the process that focuses the local improvement efforts. Unfortunately, the improvement efforts of other companies are misguided, since they're aimed at achieving cost savings rather than being totally focused on improving the flow. Ono did not invest so much effort in reducing the setup times in order to gain some cost savings. If saving cost would have been his target, he would not have wasted the time saved by further reducing the batches and therefore doing much more setups. Ono did not try to reduce the number of defective parts in order to save some trivial costs. He did it to eliminate the major disruptions to flow that result from having a defective part. Ono did not even try to squeeze better prices from Toyota suppliers or to cut the payroll of Toyota, the two main elements of cost. Rather, he put all his energy into improving the flow. What is obliterating the picture is that the end result of focusing on flow and ignoring local cost considerations is a much lower cost per unit. Exactly like the end result of abolishing local efficiencies resulting in much higher efficiency of the labor force. If it looks strange, it's because managers have not yet internalized the conceptual difference in guiding operations to concentrate on improving throughput rather than concentrating on reducing costs. One of the ramifications of concentrating on cost reduction is that almost all initiatives to foster a process of ongoing improvement quickly reach a point of diminishing returns, and as a result, many deteriorate to lip service. But that issue is too broad and too important to be squeezed into this article. In summary, both Ford and Ono followed four concepts. From now on, we'll refer to them as the concepts of flow. 1. Improving flow, or equivalently, lead time, is a primary objective of operations. 2. This primary objective should be translated into a practical mechanism that guides the operation when not to produce, prevents overproduction. Ford used space, Ono used inventory. 3. Local efficiencies must be abolished. 4. A focusing process to balance flow must be in place. Ford used direct observation. Ono used the gradual reduction of the number of containers and then gradual reduction of parts per container. The boundaries of TPS. Ono's approach in developing lean demonstrates an important idea. There's a difference between an application and the fundamental concepts on which the application is based. The fundamental concepts are generic. The application is the translation of the concepts for a specific environment. As we've already seen, the translation is not trivial and necessitates a number of solution elements. What we have to bear in mind is that the application makes assumptions, sometimes hidden assumptions, about the environment. We should not expect an application to work in environments for which its assumptions are not valid. We can save a lot of effort and frustration if we take the time to explicitly articulate these assumptions. The most demanding assumption that TPS makes about the production environment is that it is a stable environment, and it demands stability in three different aspects. The first aspect is revealed once we pay attention to the fact that even when an appropriate environment is chosen and the best experts are supervising the implementation, it takes considerable time to implement lean. Liker points out, in the Toyota way, that lean implementations led by the Toyota Supplier Support Center, TSSC, the organization Toyota created to teach U.S. companies TPS, take a minimum of 6 to 9 months per production line. This is not a surprise to anybody who's aware of the number of disruptions to flow that exist in almost any production environment and the sensitivity of the Kanban system once it starts to reach its target of low inventory. Since the Kanban system takes time to implement, its assumption is that the environment is relatively stable, that the processes and the products do not change significantly for a considerable length of time. Toyota enjoys a relatively stable environment. The car industry allows changes only once a year, a model year change, and usually from 1 year to another, the vast majority of the components are the same. That is not the case for many other industries. For example, in major sections of the electronics industry, the lifespan of most products is shorter than 6 months. To some extent, instability of products and processes exists in most other industries. For example, Hitachi Tool Engineering is producing cutting tools, a relatively stable type of product, but fierce competition forces this company to launch new cutting tools that require new technology every 6 months. It is a Sisyphean task to implement lean in such an environment. A second aspect of the stability required by TPS is stability in demand over time per product. Suppose that the lead time to produce a certain product is 2 weeks, but the demand for that product is sporadic. On average, there's just one order per quarter for that product. Currently, this product contributes to the work in process only during 2 weeks in a quarter. The rest of the time, it's not present on the shop floor. But that will not be the case under Lean, which mandates permanently holding containers for each product between each two work centers. Hitachi Tool Engineering is producing over 20,000 different SKUs. For most SKUs, the demand is sporadic. The necessity to permanently hold, for each SKU, inventory between each two work centers would lead, in the Hitachi case, to holding considerably more work-in-process inventory than what they hold today. This is apparently not a suitable environment for Ono's application. But the most demanding aspect of the stability required by TPS is stability in total load placed by the orders on the various types of resources. Suppose that, like in most companies, the orders are not uniform throughout. It is very likely that the load placed this week on a particular work center is considerably lower than its capacity, while next week the load is higher than its capacity. In this very common case, the Kanban system, that is, preventing build ahead, preventing producing ahead of time, will lead to missed due dates in the second week. Toyota's orders are relatively stable, and nevertheless, Toyota had to establish a mode of receiving orders and promising deliveries that restricts the mix change from 1 month to another. Most companies are not able to enforce such favorable conditions on their clients. It's important to note that the required stability is beyond the power of production to improve. All three aspects of stability have to do with the way the company designs and sells its products and not with the way it produces them. Unfortunately, the majority of companies suffer from at least one aspect of instability, if not from all three. The above doesn't mean that, for environments in which the assumptions of Lean are not valid, fragments of Lean cannot be used. For example, U-cells can be helpful in many environments, and setup reduction techniques can be used in almost every environment. But it does mean that in such environments, one should not expect to get the same magnitude of results that Toyota achieves, results that elevate that company into what it currently is. Using some specific techniques of Lean, being satisfied with some cost-saving programs, shouldn't be considered as implementing Lean. The importance of flow in relatively unstable environments. Ford and Ono opened our eyes to the fact that better flow, reducing lead time, leads to much more effective operations. They have demonstrated it in stable environments, but what is the impact of improved flow on relatively unstable environments? The first aspect of instability is instability due to short product life. When the product's life is short, overproduction can become obsolescence. Moreover, since the lifetime is short, long production lead times lead to missing the market demand. For example, suppose that the lifetime of a product is about 6 months, and the production lead time of that product is 2 months. The long production lead time results in lost sales, not because the demand is not there, but because, for a significant portion of the market life, production cannot satisfy the demand. The second aspect of instability is instability in demand over time per product. The common practice in environments that have a large number of SKUs that are subject to sporadic demand is to reduce the hassle by trying to satisfy this demand from stock. The disadvantage of this practice is high finished goods inventories that turn extremely slowly, coupled with high levels of shortages. A production system that's capable of organizing the shop floor to the extent that much better flow is achieved has a drastic impact on these environments. Environments that suffer from the third aspect of instability, instability in the overall load, are the ones that can gain the most from much better flow. The temporary overloads on the various resources cause these companies to usually have relatively poor due date performance, less than 90%, and as a result, they're inclined to add more capacity. Experience shows that when such companies succeed in substantially improving flow, not only do their due dates reach the high 90s, but excess capacity, as high as 50%, is revealed. Ono demonstrated that the concepts Ford introduced are not restricted to mass production of a single type of product. Even though the obstacles to apply these concepts to a less restrictive environment looked insurmountable, Ono's genius and tenacity proved to us not only that it can be done, but how to do it. We now realize that TPS is restricted to relatively stable environments. Most environments suffer from instability, and relatively unstable environments have much more to gain from better flow than even stable environments. Now that we realize the above, shouldn't we follow in the footsteps of Taiichi Ono? Shouldn't we go back to the flow concepts and derive an effective application that's suitable for the relatively unstable environments? A time-based application of the supply chain concepts. The most intuitive base for the mechanism to restrict overproduction is not space or inventory, but time. If one wants to prevent production ahead of time, one should not release the material ahead of time. Using time as the base is not only more intuitive and therefore more easily accepted by the shop floor, it has an advantage that makes it suitable for unstable environments. It's much less sensitive to disruptions in flow. The robustness of the time-based mechanism stems from the fact that it directly restricts the overall amount of work in the system rather than doing it through restricting the amount of work between each two work centers. In flow lines or Kanban-based systems, the allotted inventories between work centers is restricted to the bare minimum, usually corresponding to much less than 1 hour of work. Therefore, when a work center is down for more than a short while, the succeeding work centers are almost immediately starved for work, and the preceding work centers are blocked from working. When, for any of the work centers, the accumulated time consumed by starvation and blockage is more than the excess capacity of that work center, the throughput of the company is reduced. The sensitivity of flow lines and Kanban-based systems stems from the fact that a disruption that occurs in one work center consumes capacity also from the upstream and downstream work centers, a phenomenon that almost doesn't exist for the time-based systems, since the work, once released to the floor, is not artificially restrained. The difficulty in using a time-based system is that, for each order, we should restrict the release of the corresponding material to be an appropriate time before the due date of the order. But how does one go about computing the appropriate time? When computers appeared on the industrial scene in the early 60s, it looked like we at last had the proper tool to handle the immense amount of details and calculations needed to compute the appropriate times for each material and order. Within 10 years, many computer programs to do just that were developed in numerous companies around the world. Unfortunately, the expected results of better flow and less work in process did not materialize. The problem is that the time it takes material to be converted to a finished product ready for delivery to the client depends more on the time it has to wait in queues, waiting for a resource that's busy processing another order or waiting in front of assembly for another part to arrive, and not so much on the touch time to process the order. It's commonly known that in almost any industrial operation, except for process lines and companies that use the Kanban system, the time that a batch of parts spends being processed is only about 10% of the lead time. As a result, the decision of when to release the material determines where and how big the queues will be, which in turn determines how much time it will take to complete the order, which determines when to release the material. We were facing a chicken and egg problem. In the 70s, it was suggested to handle that problem by reiterating the procedure, closed-loop MRP, to run the computer system, to check the resulting planned overloads on the various resources, the size of the queues, to adjust the due dates to eliminate the overloads, and to repeat this process until all meaningful overloads were eliminated. This suggestion did not last long, since experience showed that the process doesn't converge, that no matter how many iterations are done, the overloads just move from one resource type to another. As a result, already in the 70s, the usage of these computer systems was not to guide the precise timing of release of material to the shop floor, but rather it was confined to giving better information on the quantities and timing to order material from the suppliers. The official names of these systems was coined to reflect their major usage, Material Requirements Planning, MRP. The fact that such a mammoth effort did not yield a practical time-based mechanism to guide operations when not to produce should not be taken as proof that such a mechanism cannot be developed for the less stable environments, environments that must meet the due dates of an uneven flow of clients' orders. It should not even discourage us from attempting to use time as the base for a practical mechanism. But it should be a warning against an approach that tries to develop such a mechanism through handling the immense amount of details and calculations. What's needed is more of a bird's-eye view approach. Going back to basics, following the concepts of flow, the objective is to improve flow, to reduce the lead time. Taking time, rather than space or inventory, as the base for the mechanism to guide the operation when not to produce, mandates that we should strive to release the corresponding material an appropriate short time just in time before the due date of the order. But what do we mean by just in time? Even though the term just in time is a key concept in Lean, its use is figurative and not quantitative. In Lean, by production just in time, we certainly don't mean that the part that was worked on just now is needed to be at the loading dock ready for shipment in the next second or minute or hour. Actually, it's likely that even under the best Kanban systems, this part will not be worked on right away by the succeeding work center, as can be deduced from the fact that full containers are routinely waiting between work centers. So, what time interval will we consider to be just in time? More explicitly, if we want to restrict overproduction by restricting the release of the material, how much time before the due date of an order should we release the material for that order? One way to reach a reasonable answer is through examining the impact the choice of that time interval has on the magnitude of the management attention required to meet all due dates. Suppose that we release material before the due date by just the time it actually takes to process the order. Such a choice will necessitate a lot of management attention to closely monitor operations, since any delay in any operation, or even a delay in moving the parts between operations, will result in missing the due date. Moreover, precise scheduling will be needed to ensure that no queues will occur, since any queue causes a delay for the parts waiting in the queue. This is certainly not a practical choice. Even infinite management attention will not be sufficient to meet all due dates. We must choose a longer interval of time, an interval that contains safety to accommodate delays. The need to include safety is the reason for referring to the time interval of release of material before the due date as the time buffer. Choosing longer time buffers elongates the lead time and increases work in process. But since longer time buffers means more safety time, expectations are that, with much less management attention, a higher percentage of orders will be completed on or before their respective due dates. This is correct for relatively short time buffers, but when the time buffers are considerable, another phenomenon starts to raise its ugly head. What we have to bear in mind is that the longer the chosen time buffer, the earlier material is released, which means that more orders are simultaneously present on the shop floor. When there are too many orders on the floor, traffic jams start to occur. The more traffic jams, the more management attention is needed to sort out the priorities. Operations that implemented Ford's or Ono's systems enjoy an average lead time which is only a few times longer than the actual touch time, and management does not have to invest almost any attention to guide the shop floor personnel on what to work on now. As we said, in conventional plants, batches of parts spend only about 10% of the time being processed. About 90% of the time, the batches are either waiting in a queue for a resource or waiting for another type of part to be assembled together. What we learned from Ford, and more so from Ono, is that we shouldn't accept the size of batches as given, that economical batch quantities are not economical, and instead, we should and can strive to reach a one-piece flow. Armed with that conviction, it's easy to realize that when a batch of parts is being processed, except in processes like mixing or curing, only one item is actually worked on while the other items in the batch are waiting. That means that in conventional companies that use batch sizes of more than 10 units in a batch, which is the case in the majority of production environments, the touch time is actually less than 1% of the lead time. There is another phenomenon that typifies these companies. Whatever the formal priority system is, if a formal priority system exists at all, the actual priority system is hot, red hot, and drop everything, do it now. Inefficient operations means being in a lose-lose situation. Lead times are very long relative to the touch time, inventories are high, and in many cases the company suffers from poor due date performance, less than 90%, in spite of high management attention. Bearing in mind that if management would have chosen a shorter time buffer, the situation would be remarkably better. How can it be that the vast majority of conventionally run companies are in that lose-lose situation? The answer was given by Ford and Ono. Through their work, they decisively proved that, contrary to the common belief, striving to constantly activate all resources all the time is not a recipe for effective operations. On the contrary, the exact opposite is true. To reach effective operations, local efficiencies must be abolished. But conventional companies do try to reach full activation of resources. Whenever the upstream resources are not bottlenecks, and that's the case in the vast majority of environments, they will from time to time run out of work. To prevent it, material is released, material that's needed for more remote orders, or even for forecasted orders. The unavoidable consequence is longer queues. Longer queues cause some orders not to be fulfilled on time, which in turn is interpreted as, we should release the material earlier, and is also interpreted as, we don't have enough capacity. A good starting point for improving flow will be to choose the time buffer to be equal to half the current lead time. There's no point wasting time by trying to find or calculate the optimum point. The immediate benefits are too significant to postpone. Restricting the release of material to be just the time buffer, half the current lead time, before the corresponding due date of the orders, will considerably improve the due date performance, will reduce the lead time to half of what it is now, and therefore, as the excess inventories are flushed out, will shrink the work-in-process inventory to less than half of its current level. But one cannot expect that this change alone will bring the due date performance to the high 90s. Simply, there are still many orders on the shop floor. There are queues in front of resources, and leaving to chance the sequence in which the work is processed will cause many orders to finish late. A priority system is needed. The need for a priority system should not open the gates for sophisticated algorithms to set the priorities. The number of orders coming in is constantly changing. The content of work differs from one order to another. The length of the queue is constantly changing, and let's not forget that disruptions still occur. In short, this is an environment with high variability. The lesson that Schuhart brought to manufacturing from physics, and Deming made known worldwide, is that trying to be more accurate than the noise, in our case trying to use sophisticated algorithms that consider every possible parameter in an environment of high variability, does not improve things but makes them worse. The results will most certainly not be an improvement, but a deterioration in due date performance. A straightforward priority system emerges when we recognize that the time buffer, being half of the current lead time, is still much longer than the touch time, and since it dramatically reduces the traffic jams without any interference, many orders will be finished within just one-third of the time buffer, and the majority will be finished within the first two-thirds of the time buffer. Based on that realization, priorities are assigned by buffer management. Per batch, the time that has passed since its release is tracked. If less than one-third of the time buffer has passed, the priority color is green. If more than one-third but less than two-thirds, the priority color is yellow. If more than two-thirds, the color is red. If the due date has passed, the color is black. Blacks have higher priority than reds, etc. If two batches have the same color, to try and decide which one should be worked on first is an excellent example of trying to be more accurate than the noise. Putting such a system on the shop floor is relatively easy. In the first step, there's no need to do any physical changes, just to choke the release of material to be half the historical lead time before the corresponding due date and to guide the shop floor to follow the color code priority system. The impact is impressive, especially when compared to the efforts required. Of course, local efficiencies must be abolished. Otherwise, the pressure to release material too early will continue. Experience shows that the speed at which everybody on the shop floor realizes the positive impact makes that change almost resistance-free. But in most environments, there are still orders that miss their due dates, and there's still enormous potential for improvement to capitalize on. The fourth concept must also be translated into practice. A focusing process to balance flow must be in place. The first step in balancing the flow is relatively easy. Choking the release of material exposes the abundant excess capacity that was masked before. But it's likely that some work centers have less excess capacity than the rest. These work centers are flagged, since they do have a queue of inventory in front of them. The fact that local efficiencies are abolished helps to identify the simple actions required to increase their capacity. Simple actions, such as ensuring that a capacity-constrained work center will not stay idle during lunch break or shift changes, and offloading work to less efficient work centers that have ample excess capacity, are some examples. Since the above actions add effective capacity to the work centers that cause queues, the queues become shorter, and fewer orders reach the red status. This means that the time buffer becomes unnecessarily long. An effective rule to adjust the time buffer without taking a risk of deteriorating the high due date performance is to decrease the time buffer when the number of red orders is smaller than 5% of the number of total released orders, and to increase it when the proportion of red orders is more than 10%. A company that follows the above will, within a few months, find itself with very high due date performance, considerably shorter lead times, and ample excess capacity. This is when the real challenge begins. In the past, sometimes, too many times, the reaction of top managers to the fully exposed excess capacity was to right-size the capacity and gain cost savings. This is a grave mistake. The excess capacity is employees who just helped the company to improve, and as a direct consequence, are rewarded by losing their jobs or their friends' jobs. In all the cases when such a misguided action was taken, the unavoidable backlash quickly deteriorated the plant performance to worse than the starting point. Hopefully, such top management behavior is behind us. The more sensible way to deal with the exposed excess capacity is to capitalize on it, to encourage the sales force to take advantage of the improved performance to gain more sales. The increased sales can easily cause the emergence of a real bottleneck. Ignoring the bottleneck's limited capacity when giving due date commitments to new orders will deteriorate the due date performance, and sales from disappointed clients will plummet. It is essential to strengthen the tie between sales and operations. That's the real challenge. A system must be put in place to ensure that every due date commitment is given only according to the yet unallocated capacity of the bottleneck. The bottleneck becomes the drumbeat for the orders. The time buffer translates due dates into release dates, and the action of choking the release becomes the rope that ties the order to the release of work. That is the reason this time-based application of the theory of constraints became known as the drum buffer rope system, or in short, DBR. Currently, there's widespread experimentation to polish a process to further improve operations based on recording and analyzing the reasons for the red orders. Example of Hitachi. By 2008, Hitachi Tool Engineering Limited had become a 24 billion yen company that designs and manufactures over 20,000 different cutting tools. The demand for most of their products is sporadic, and the customs of their industry force them to launch new product families of tools every 6 months. When new product families are launched, the older families become obsolete. No wonder their efforts to implement lean were unsuccessful. Hitachi Tool Engineering Limited started implementing DBR in one of their four plants in Japan in 2000. The jump in due date performance from 40% to 85%, associated with cutting WIP, work in process, and lead times in half, along with the ability to ship 20% more products with the same labor force, encouraged them to expand the implementation. By 2003, they had implemented DBR in all four plants. The drastic reduction in lead time and the much better responsiveness enabled a reduction of inventory in the supply chain, the outside distributors, from 8 to 2.4 months' worth. The reduction of inventory dramatically improved the distributors' return on investment, freed up their cash, and strengthened their relationships with Hitachi. No wonder the distributors expanded the range of Hitachi tools that they were offering, leading to an increase of 20% in sales in a stable market. The true impact is revealed when we evaluate this company's bottom-line performance, keeping in mind that during the period of 2002 to 2007, the price of raw materials, metals, increased much more than the increase in the selling price of cutting tools. Under such conditions, the profits of the company should have vanished. Instead, the annual net profit before taxes of Hitachi Tool Engineering Limited increased from 1.1 billion yen in the fiscal year ending March 2002 to 5.3 billion yen in the year ending March 2007, a five-fold increase in net profit in 5 years. The profit ratio of Hitachi Tool Engineering Limited increased from 7.2% in 2002 to 21.9% in 2007, the highest ratio ever reported in this type of industry. The boundaries of DBR. As was highlighted before, an application makes assumptions, sometimes hidden assumptions, about the environment, and we should not expect the application to work in environments for which its assumptions are not valid. The assumption that DBR makes is apparent. It assumes that the touch time is very small, less than 10%, compared to the current lead time. This assumption is valid for many, if not most, typical production environments. But definitely, it's not valid for a very broad range of environments that are traditionally called project environments. In project environments, the touch time is relatively long, and the eagerness of the clients to get the project completed forces operations to promise lead times which are only twice or rarely three times longer than the touch time. It's no wonder that the performance is so bad that no one expects to get the project completed on time, in budget, and with the full content. Something is expected to give. But we should not conclude that since DBR's assumption is not valid, DBR is inappropriate for project environments. A different application, An application that directly addresses the relatively long touch time is needed. This approach is called critical chain.